Hello and welcome to Boring Beige Box, the weekly podcast about retro computing. I'm your host, Matt Wilson. If you like to hack away at your autoexec.bat or config.sys files just so you can play King's Quest or Ultima, you're at the right place. From 2400 baud modems to IBM PS1s, to Monkey Island 2, to the Sierra Network, we cover it all if it happened in the 80s and 90s. So clean out that garage, pull out that old boring beige box, and let's have some fun. Welcome to show number 6 for May 19th, 2006. Today's topic is Towers of Power, Part 1. The 386 and 486. Well, glad you can make it. Thanks for tuning in. I am definitely glad that it is the end of the week and it's time to relax. Take it easy. Do some stuff around the house. Work on some projects. I recently just seeded my lawn at the house here and bought a lawnmower today. Haven't mowed a lawn in a very long time. Ever since college, I've either lived in a dorm or I've lived in an apartment after college or a condo or a townhome. But about a year ago, my wife and I bought a house, and so we just got the yard done about a month or two ago, and now it's finally tall enough to cut. So we bought a lawnmower and cut the grass, and I feel like I did back when I was at home with the parents. It's like a big chore. I used to hate mowing the lawn. Anyway, much rather play in the garage with old computers. First off, I would like to just say thank you to all of my listeners. Thank you for sending an email and checking out the website and jumping on the forums. It's much appreciated. We do have a couple people that have registered. But if you are listening, I do encourage you to check out our website. It is www.boringbeigebox.com, and there's also some forums on there. If you go to forums.boringbeigebox.com, you'll go directly to the forums. You can register, and you can chat away. There's lots of different sections on the forums, so I would definitely check that out. Also, if you just want to drop me a line, just say thanks for listening. I would greatly appreciate it. Just send me an email to podcast@boringbeigebox.com. Well, this past week I've been into revisiting or relooking at the BBS documentary by Jason Scott. And I highly, highly, highly recommend this documentary. It is incredible. I've watched a couple. It's broken up into a couple different sections. There's the BAUD section. That's B-A-U-D. It introduces the story of the beginning of the BBS, including interviews with Ward Christensen, who was the Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss were the guys that created the first BBS. It also talks about, there's another section, SysOps and Users. I'm just reading from Jason Scott's website. It introduces the story of the people who use BBSs and lets them tell their own stories of living in this new world. That's a great section. Make It Pay basically talks about, it covers the BBS industry that rose in the 1980s and grew to fantastic heights before disappearing almost overnight. So that's basically how people started charging for software in different conventions. I just finished the FidoNet section, which I've seen all this before, but it's been about a year or so. I got it right when it came out. FidoNet was basically a collection of bulletin boards that sent mail, email, and news-related information to other bulletin boards. So you kind of could keep up. It was just like internet. I mean, it was just like the web, but it was pre-web, and it covers, and this is from the website, covers the largest volunteer-run computer network in history. and the people who made it a joy and a political nightmare. It ended up having a lot of political problems. But and FidoNet is still running in a lot of third world countries that are not able to access high-speed internet. They can still do dial-up, and they're not allowed to use the web, or it's censored, so they can still use bulletin boards to get out information and news. There's another section, and I've seen this before. This is where I haven't watched the rest of this second time around, but there's the art scene, which talks about the ANSI art scene. If you remember the graphics that use the ANSI characters to create graphics on the websites and stuff, it was pretty cool stuff. HPAC, which is hacking, freaking, anarchy, and cracking. A lot of the underground stuff that went on the BBS, that's another section. Compression is another portion of the documentary. Tells a story of PKWare. Remember PK Unzip and the SEA company. A lot of the way that you could compress files for bulletin boards. If it was a large download, you could use these different software. And but there was a lot of battles regarding who owned what and the different types of data compression. So that's a good section. No carrier is the last section, which is a fond farewell to the dial-up BBS and its integration into the internet. So definitely going to watch some more of that, but that has really really made me feel nostalgic about the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and using bulletin boards. And like I've said, I did that whole experience. If you use bulletin boards, you always had that experience. Usually, or most people had the experience of calling all the long distance BBSs because there was never any good local BBSs, for you, depending on where you lived. And you always dialed up long distance ones. And the 1 month that you dialed way too many, spent too much time on them, and you get the phone bill from your parents for like $500 or more at the end of the month. And that happened to me, and the bill was enormous, and my mom was very mad at me, and I ended up spending months trying to pay that off. So I learned my lesson. Do not dial long distance. It's very expensive. So, but then around the time, that's when AOL and some of the other online services, had local numbers. So you could just dial up to them, to the online services, and which I did more of that anyway instead of the BBSs. And then you could... eventually, and then the internet came around about the time I went off to college in 95. So, I've really been watching that documentary. It's great. I would definitely check it out. BBSdocumentary.com. Buy it now. Watch it. Love it. Enjoy it. So, okay. Today's topic, like I said, is Towers of Power. That was kind of a buzzword or kind of a name that... advertisers would use for these enormous, towers that were usually 386 or 486 base machines. I mean, you remember it's the full tower form factor for computer cases, and they were enormous. They were incredibly huge. I want to cover those, but also just the enormous desktop. The horizontal, or vertical. I always get those two confused. But the desktop systems were also enormous. I mean, these were systems that carried, the huge ISA cards or even the Visa local bus cards that were enormous back in the day. So also one quick note, I have gotten some emails in, but I want to share that at the end of the... end of the podcast, end of the show today. So the Towers of Power were, this was the era, the height of the boring beige box. Enormous machines that were usually 386 or 486 based. So I'm looking at, I have a copy. I collected so many different PC magazines, and at the time it was, I would say, definitely early 90s, 91, 92 through about 95. I subscribed to a bunch of different computer magazines, specifically Computer Shopper. And if you remember Computer Shopper at that time, Computer Shopper was an oversized PC magazine. It was enormous. If you remember these things, they were just gigantic, totally oversized and immensely thick. And I remember taking those and just pouring through and looking at computer ads and hoping and wishing for different machines that I could buy or build. So I ended up throwing out all of those magazines. I had a huge stack, and they were very heavy, and they were in the attic, and my dad was like, okay, are you going to get rid of these or not? Are you going to take them with you to college? What are you going to do with them? And I ended up throwing them out, and I really wish I'd saved them. But I do have a few that I did save. One of the earliest magazines I have, and this one is just, I mean, this I will never throw away. This is PC Sources. They're definitely not around anymore, but I don't know if you remember this one. PC Sources from March 1992. And on the front, it says, big screens, direct values on 17-inch monitors. And it's got a picture of a CTX monitor, you know, a very large bevel, gray and beige, obviously. And it's got a, on the screen, it has a chart, a graph chart created in Freelance Graphics on Windows 3.1. So, and it has a big tower on the front by Comtrade. Comtrade is the name of the company. With, remember the turbo button on the front? And then the LED little display says 33, I guess for 33 megahertz. And it's got 2 3.5 drives and 1 big 5.25. So, anyway, so this, you know, there's tons of companies. And if you remember this during the time, remember these different companies. Do you guys remember Zeos? Z-E-O-S? They were always in the front of the magazines. I'm looking at them. It's a huge desktop system. And it is a 386SX 20 megahertz with 4 megabytes of RAM, 107 megabyte hard drive, VGA color, comes with Lotus 1-2-3 and AMI Pro 2.0. And it's for $2,000. Can you believe that? A 386 was at one time $2,000. I mean, it's nuts. I mean, you go through the whole magazine. The 486s in here are like $5,000 and $6,000. I mean, it's nuts. Yep, they have... there is a, let's see, there's a loaded Zeos 486 33 megahertz screamer with 4 megabytes of RAM, 130 megabyte drive, VGA color. I love this. It says 4 megabytes of zero weight state RAM. Zero weight RAM. Okay. You know, remember how slow 4 megabytes was? And it's expandable. And this, it says it's expandable to a whopping 32 megabytes on the motherboard. Oh, man. It's so funny how times have changed. I mean, this is just, well, it's been, you know, almost 15 years. So 10 years ago, so 13 years, I would say. Let's see. It comes with a 14-inch high-res 1024 by 768 non-interlaced. Remember interlaced and non-interlaced? That was... an older technology, VGA color monitor. It comes with a high-speed Diamond Speedstar high-color VGA graphics with 1 megabyte of RAM. Wow. So anyway, PC Sources, it was a great magazine. There are so many different companies in here. I remember just drooling over that I don't see at all anymore. I mean, they're all gone. Gateway 2000, they're still around. But my word, I mean, there's... the 486 I was looking at that I just read to you from Zeos, the total on that was $3,000. Here's a Gateway 2000. It's a 486 with 8 megabytes of RAM, 5.25 drive, 3.5 inch drive, 340 megabyte SCSI drive, 32-bit enhanced ISA SCSI controller, 16-bit VGA with 1 megabyte, and a 14-inch crystal scan. I remember those. Gateway 2000 called them crystal scan. Color VGA monitors with DOS 5.0 and Windows 3.0 for $38.95. I think one time I paid $25 for a 486 machine at like a Goodwill store or an old computer store when I lived in Seattle. I mean, that's nuts. $38.95. So I'm just looking through. There's tons of pictures of the boring beige boxes. They're enormous. The desktop machine, the tower machines are just enormous. So the whole Tower of Power was, you know, they any of the mid tower or the full tower machines, they would call them Towers of Power. Now I had a 386SX 25 megahertz with either 2 or 4 megabytes of RAM and a 40 megabyte hard drive, and it was a mini tower. There was the mini, the mid, and the full tower. Now I don't see, like, when you go into a store, most of the machines that are sold are like either mini towers or mid towers. Most of them are all minis, like your HP, your Sony, your E-Machines, Compaq. Those are all mini towers. I never see any full towers anymore. They've pretty much died out or gone away, unless they're for servers. But now most servers are rack servers. And a lot of companies used the full towers as servers. And the place I work, when I first started working there a couple years ago, they had just decommissioned one of the file servers, and I'm looking at it right now. I actually picked it up and took it home. They were going to throw it out. I decided to keep it. It was running NetWare 3.2 or 3.12. I'm actually looking at it right now. It was running Novell NetWare version 3.12. If any of you networking guys remember that. I really didn't use Novell that much, but and it is a 486 SX 25 megahertz with 8 megs of RAM, and this thing is a beast. It's enormous. And let's see here. I'm going to turn it on and see if you can hear how loud it sounds. Hear that spinning? I think that's the hard drive spinning. Yeah, it sounds like the hard drives or the fan. But this thing is a beast. I mean, it looks like it's got 2 SCSI hard drives. It has this enormous tape drive. On the front, it says Business Tech 8200. It has a tape backup drive, a 3M Magnus 1.0 data cartridge. It's as big as like a paperback book almost. And it's 1 gigabyte, 1 whole gigabyte. That's probably larger than the hard drives combined. Anyway, it's a huge tape backup. It's got the I/O cards in there, the VGA card, all the RAM. I mean, this thing is a beast. The power supply is enormous. And it's 230, looks like it's only 230 watts, but it's gigantic. So I actually can't get it to come up. It's not the disk. It came off a boot disk, and it doesn't seem to load, or the disk failed. But when I reboot, then it doesn't boot into any type of partition. So I think I'm gonna have to lose all the data. So I'll have to maybe I can get a Linux boot disk. I can get into a real basic Linux that runs off of maybe a floppy disk. So. Anyway, so that's the Tower of Power that I own. And I have a couple of machines here that I'm looking at now. I have a Gateway 2000, and now it's actually a Pentium. And I'm going to get into Pentium chips next podcast. Most of the machines I have they're either all-in-one or they're a pretty large desktop, the flat, you know, desktop type machine. But when you look at the size of these things, they're really big compared to today's computers. Everything has gotten so much smaller today. These boxes were just enormous. I mean, imagine all the desk space that you have to put the desktops, the long type of desktops, the flat desktops on your desk. I mean, it took up so much space. I'm also looking at, I have a Compaq Presario Model 433. It's an all-in-one system. This is my favorite system. I remember, this is not the same one I got, but I recently bought this off of eBay a while back. It's the same kind of all-in-one system that I had for a short time. It's the I'm looking at the back of it. It's just Compact Presario 433. It's like a 486, and it's an all-in-one system. They made these for a while where the screen, it's like a 14-inch monitor. It's all built in. It has a really small footprint, and all it has is a floppy disk drive on the front. But the insides, the bottom part, the actual just motherboard, is very, very small, and it just slides right into the back. It looks like there's a modem in there. And actually an Ethernet card. And you've got your... it does have a built-in modem, too. And keyboard and mouse, and that's pretty much it. And then your serial and your parallel port. And a game port for joystick. So that was a machine I had, too. I actually have a video of me and my my dad taped me and my brother. This was back in, like, 94 when I brought home the Compact Presario all-in-one. So got that on video. Definitely good times. I think it ran, we had like Windows 3.0, and you know, it came with a bunch of software. So okay, during that time there was the 386 and the 486. Now I want to talk a little bit about first about the 386. The 386 came out in 1986, and it pretty much was not discontinued or stopped being used mainstream around 1994. Now, most of the, like I said, the first system I had was based on the 386, and it ran for a fairly long time. If you look on Wikipedia, if you do a search on the 386, it has a lot of information about this chip. Now, the cool thing about the 386 was it was originally designed and configured by Compaq and Intel, and they actually, you know, had a connection where they came out with the chip, Compaq and Intel, instead of IBM. So it talks a little bit about that just in the beginning. It says the first personal computer to make use of the 386 was designed and manufactured by Compaq and Andy Grove, Intel's CEO at the time, made the decision to single source the processor, decisions that were ultimately crucial to both the processors and Intel's success in the market. So normally this is something that, you know, IBM would have done, but they had a one-up on them. It says, under the business importance section, it says the first PC company to design and manufacture a PC based on the 386 was Compaq rather than IBM, which had been dominant until that time. IBM was offered use of the processor, but relied instead on earlier processors to which it had manufacturing rights. The success of the Compaq 386 PC played an important role in creating the PC clone industry and to establishing Intel and Microsoft as central component suppliers to it. So that is the point. That I feel that was the turning point. That was when IBM, you know, even though they created the original PC, this is when the 386 began to take over, and then the clones, the really when the boring beige boxes began, and there were so many different PC clones based off the 386 chip. So I found this pretty interesting. The 386 continued on until they said that the 386 would cease at the end of September 2007. So Intel's continued to manufacture the 386 mainly as embedded systems, you know, for smaller devices and stuff. That all it takes is a 386 to run them if they do very, very simple things. But you know, back in the day, that was our main processor. But I, like I said, my first machine was a 386, but I quickly got into the 486. And a couple notes, though, about the 386. There was three operating modes: real mode, protected mode, and virtual mode. In the real mode, the 386, like the 286, would run just as fast 8186. The protected mode allowed the use of all the possibilities of the 286 and the protected mode extension of the 386, especially addressing up to 4 gigabytes of memory. Finally, the virtual 8086 or V86 mode made it possible to run one or more virtual 8086 machines in protected environment. So that was kind of the specialty of the 386. Also, some other notes, there was the SX line, these different lines that they started coming out with. The SX model was a lower cost version of the 386, just like how Pentium had the Celeron version. It was a bit cheaper. They were able to it says the SX series of chips was 32-bit internally but had a 16-bit external bus. So it was a little bit different. So there was no 32-bit physical address space extension. And I'm like I said, I'm reading most of this from the Wikipedia article. So, but then at that time when they had the SX, they renamed the 386 to the 386DX to avoid confusion, it says. So, also, and I don't know if you remember this, but there was a separate socket for math coprocessors. It says neither CPU included a math coprocessor. Most motherboards included a socket for an 8387. You would get the 387 separate math coprocessor. And it says, yeah, though the naming would cause some head-scratching later when the 486 came in a DX variant that did include floating point capability, which was physically present but disabled in early 486 SXs. There was also the 386 SL, which was used for laptop computers. And I think I might have had one that was based on that had that chip in. So then very quickly the 486 came out, which, you know, to me, I would say taking a machine like the a machine that's based on the 486 is the best retro computer, early 90s computer to have in your collection. If you're wanting to do a lot of fun stuff, there's two different eras. And if you're going to, my big thing is gaming and maybe some online stuff or either, well, mainly gaming. And if you want to run maybe Windows 3.1 or something like that, the greatest system to have, I think, is a 486-based system. And then maybe if you want to get into the era of Doom and when that kind of that stuff kind of came out in the mid-90s, I'd go with a Pentium, you know, like a Pentium 120, Pentium 90. Those machines are good to have to kind of play the when kind of the gaming world turned into the first-person shooters and stuff. So the 486 was probably one of the most popular right before the Pentium. The Pentium, I believe, has been Intel's most popular chip. Obviously, it's still called Pentium today. But the whole numbering system, they had a large battle over the different numbering system with AMD and the idea that you can't, you know, Intel wanted to copyright a number, basically. They wanted to copyright the number 8386 or 8486, but they were not allowed to do that. So the first way they went along with this is they just called it the Intel 486 or the Intel I-46. The 486 basically had a couple different models, couple different structures. There was the SX, the DX, the DX2, the DX4. If you remember this at the time, there were so many different variations of the 486 that you could get. And it was all based on, you know, it was all price structures and, you know, the SX was the cheapest. And I think I went through, I had a 486 SX, I had a 486 DX. I remember using the DX2 and the DX4 was like the big dog. I mean, anytime they came out with those higher level processors of the different, you know, kind of coding on the end of it, they could always charge an arm and a leg for it because it was faster. Or like the DX4, it says designed to run at triple clock rate, not quadruple, you know, as the 4, as often believed. The DX3 was meant to run at 2.5x the clock speed but was never released. So this is all, if you look up 486 on Wikipedia, it talks all about it. The different clock rates, it was for megahertz, it was 16. For the 486, it went from 16 megahertz to 20 to 25 to 33, 40 megahertz, 50 megahertz, 66, you remember 66 megahertz, 75 megahertz, and then even 100 megahertz. Remember the DX4, 100 megahertz, I mean, that was the fastest. And this is the one, yeah, I remember the most. It was the 486 DX2. 66 megahertz. It says it was the most widespread high-end 486 chip. That's the one I remember the most. So The 386 had, I think it went from 16 megahertz up to maybe 33, maybe either 25 or 33 megahertz. So those two were the big dogs of the time. I mean, like I said, the 486 is the one that I feel is probably your best to work with if you're wanting to do some old school computing. The earliest 486 was released in 1989 as the 25 megahertz version. Then the 33 megahertz version in 1990, and then the 50 megahertz in 1991. I don't know when they kind of discontinued it or began to move on from the 486. If you look at the Pentium section, well, the first Pentium shipped in 1993, so that's probably about the time that things began to switch over to Pentium. But I want to talk about that in the next show, because the Pentium itself has an entire line that continued, as you know, for many, many years up until today. So, well, that's about it. We're at about 30 minutes into the program now, and I want to wrap up and talk to you a little bit about some of the email I've been getting in and some other various topics. I want to say thank you so much for writing in. There's a couple different people. Ismo continues to write in. He, after listening to the LucasArts episode, he basically says, "Hello, Matt. I really enjoyed the LucasArts episode with my best friend. Always I played adventure games after school." He says, "From LucasArts, we played Maniac Mansion, Sam & Max, The Secret of Monkey Island, Monkey Island 2, Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, Day of the Tentacle, Full Throttle, The Curse of Monkey Island, Grim Fandango." So he played all of them. He also mentioned the Seventh Guest. Do you remember Seventh Guest by Virgin Interactive? It was like had the whole full motion video was a big craze in the early 90s. And he also played the Simon the Sorcerer, which I do remember some of those. He mentions to check out a website, Abandonia, I think you say. It's an abandonware site, abandonia.com. Lots of good old DOS games. And that's it from Ismo. He is from the Netherlands. So thanks, Ismo, for writing in. Also, a guy by the name of Thurston Johnston wrote in. He goes, "Hi, Matt. Thought I would drop you a line to say I like the podcast. It complements RetroBits very nicely." I say thank you, Thurston, for that. RetroBits was the inspiration for my podcast with Earl Evans, and he's doing a great job over there. He goes, "Have an idea for a future podcast." And this is actually, I think, based on his email, this is why I'm doing the podcast on the different processors of the day. He goes, "How about covering the industry's race to 1 gigahertz? I remember following this and getting excited as to what chip manufacturer would get there first. 1 gigahertz seemed like the holy grail of PC speeds." And he's kind of talking about how, AMD and Intel were racing towards the 1 gigahertz mark. And that probably goes out of the scope of kind of the era that we're covering. I know that the Pentium chip went up as high as 300 megahertz by 1999. So I think it was after that, from what I'm reading correctly, it went up in speed over time. But definitely, I mean, that's kind of, thank you so much, Thurston. That's kind of like why I'm doing the show, this two-part episodes on the different processors of the day. So, like I said, thanks for everyone writing in. There were some people that were posting on the forums. That's at forums.boringbeigebox.com. And there's been a little bit of activity. Different people talking about the podcast and some of the games they played, some of the BBSs they dialed up to, or online services. People have been listing their collection. So I would definitely check it out, register, jump on the forums, and let's talk. It's summertime. Summertime is here almost, pretty much, and I'm really interested in conventions. I know that there's a vintage computer festival coming up in this is done, if you go to vintage.org, this organization puts on a lot of different vintage computer festivals or computer shows throughout the year. Now, I believe they started in California, but now they have them throughout the country and even overseas. There is one that's coming up in my area. It's the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest 2.0. This is the second year. It is at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. That's about an hour and a half from where I live in Northwest Indiana. So it's not too far away, and I am definitely going to go to that. If you go to vintage.org and click on events, and then click on the Midwest Festival, it's Saturday, July 15th of this year. So that's not too far away. I definitely want to go, and I actually would like to do a booth and bring some of my some of my boring beige boxes and do a little display, and probably also promote the podcast and get a big banner and all that kind of stuff. So if you live in the Midwest area, I would definitely check this out. That's a big convention conference coming up. I heard last year's wasn't too big, but it's not about the size in conferences that counts, unlike in other things, but it is definitely important just to go and just to spend time with the community and get to know, make a few friends and talk about retro computing. So that's going on. There's some other stuff. There's some classic gaming conventions that I know are going on. Actually, very, very soon, there's one called, I forget the name, Midwest Classic, which I think is in Milwaukee. Midwest Gaming Classic, where they have a lot of stand-up arcade games and then also some your typical old console systems and stuff. And it's it looks like a lot of people. Last year, there was like 1,200 attendees. But it is right near Milwaukee, Minnesota, I believe. But I would go, and no, it is Wisconsin. I'm sorry, Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. I can't even say it. Anyway, check out the website. It's MidwestGamingClassic.com. That looks like a fun convention, also. Any other conventions, if you know of anything, just go to the convention section on the forums and post and let me know what's up. Well, that about does it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week, and I will talk to you soon. Thanks.